share a few events that are coming up or will soon be coming up. And as I say that now, we have just slipped over to 5 o'clock. Welcome either back to if you've been listening, or welcome to if you just tuned in. CFRC 101.9 FM. We are located in Lower Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. My name is Bruce, and this is Finding a Voice, a spoken word program airing here every Friday afternoon from 4 to 6 o'clock. We do stream live online as well at www.cfrc.ca. Coming up on the show today, in the first hour, from an October 23rd event at Novel Idea Bookstore, what you heard, I should say, in the first hour, if you were tuned in, was psychiatrist, cyclist, and author Francois May launching and reading from his two volumes, his two very recent volumes, With Hope in My Heart, Musings of a Spirited Psychiatrist, and then also Mr. Francois' Cycling Escapades. And I'm also letting people know that just tuned in case, because as I will mention, both hours of this show are uploaded to my personal blog space for it at Finding a Voice on cfrcfm.wordpress.com. And you could hear it again, or you could hear it there if you missed it in the first hour. And coming up in this hour now, from an October 29th launch event at Novel Idea Bookstore again, you're going to hear Toronto-based editor and writer Aviva Rubin launching her debut novel called White. Before I do that, though, I would like to, like I did in the first hour, just a quick plug for our funding drive. It's open, began November 1st. And runs until December 31st. In it, you can donate either through Queen's or CFRC. And if you go through Queen's, you can get a tax receipt. If you go through us, you'll be eligible for gifts and more. If you just go to our website, which is www.cfrc.ca, and then also at the top of the page, you'll see sublinks. And if you click on donate, it will explain to you how you can decide what you want to get. You get gifts from us. You get a tax receipt. If you go through the Queen's section in there, it all comes to us, your funds. It's just we can't print out tax receipts. So Queen's is doing that for us. Also, I just want to kind of plug, I mentioned this too in the first hour, that this funding drive is really important to me too. We have a goal of $25,000, and I just want to say without this station, there wouldn't be this audio show that has allowed me to share over, I don't know, well over 1,200 lit events, happenings, and interviews in the last 14 and a half years. This is a special place. For those of you who have already donated, my heartfelt thanks. And there have been a lot. We've gotten some donations in. If you haven't yet, please go again to our website, www.cfrc.ca. Check it out. Just click on the donate tab at the top of the page there, and you'll see a lot of information. And just want to let you know, every little bit helps, so thanks so much. And now with that, I think we're going to go ahead and move into the second book launch on the show today. Coming up now then in this second hour, let me see if I got it queued up here. Looks like we're close. From an October 29th launch event at Novel Idea Bookstore, you'll hear Toronto-based editor and writer Aviva Rubin launching her debut novel called White. Here we go. Enjoy.
That's good. So I thought, should I just start? I think I'll just start.
Yeah.
So I'm going to start by reading two or three little sections from the book, and then I have a few things that I'm going to say, and then whoever wants to ask me any questions is free to ask me any questions. I don't know if you sort of have a sense of what the book is about. It's the story of a young woman who grows up in a white supremacist family. She has a couple of encounters. She makes a couple of friendships that make her change her views, and she decides to try to fight the movement sort of from within, and with kind of dire consequences. So that's essentially, that's like the nutshell of what the book is about. Not light fare, exactly.
No.
Okay, so this is the very beginning, and this chapter is called Train Line, Montreal to Toronto. There was a knock on the door. You okay? How did she even get here in this cramped toilet, on this train, with her head between her knees? Wasn't that what you did to get ready for a crash? Put your head down? Or was that only for flying? Her crash and burn already happened. This was the part that came after, and it was way worse. That cop was waiting outside. She looked at the sink and the paper towel dispenser. No sharp edges. Maybe he only got paid for the safe delivery of a live person. It was tempting not to answer and see if he'd bang his way in. I'm fine. Not loud enough. She cleared her throat and said it again, this time too loud. Sarah felt dizzy when she stood up and grabbed the counter. Her greasy-haired reflection made her pull her wool toque down further. Luce had suggested a shower to so Sarah didn't offend anyone who could fuck things up for her, but she hadn't bothered. How much more to be? Back at her seat, she sat crunched against the window. She and the cop had only been inches apart since they left her apartment hours ago. Sarah had no idea why he was even there. Something about it being for her own safety, he'd said. Cartel, you sure you're okay? Why did he keep asking? Of course she wasn't looking okay. She was being accompanied to a loony bin for safekeeping. She'd accomplished nothing in a year and a half of trying. A pile of unfinished assignments and missed exams she'd never bothered begging extensions for or making excuses lay trashed behind her at McGill University. Not that the cop knew that part of the story. He'd probably only heard about how upset she was at the police station after Aravinda was attacked. Her fault. Maybe the frequent visits to the toilet had him worried about a urinary tract infection or a drug addiction. I'm fine, like I was 5 minutes ago. Ignoring the sarcasm, he offered her half of his egg salad sandwich, which was kind, but while she was hungry, she was not that hungry. The wife made it. The wife. Like wives were all interchangeable. Egg salad made her think of Luce again, who hated it too. And then about how the plan when Sarah had left Goderich for McGill had felt clear and controllable. How she hadn't noticed it getting away from her, but Luce had. She waved no thanks at the sandwich. Sarah's hand rested on the poster tube jammed between her thigh and the window, the white supremacy at a glance mural that had taken years of research and still wasn't done. Just finished something. The attendant breathed egg beside her. His eyes were closed, but she could tell he was awake. She wished she could sleep. Not that it helped stop the images. A laughing Aravinda with his worn leather bag of demo flyers banging against his skinny ass, planting kisses on Sarah's cheeks. He was pretty much the only person she let do that, even though it was Montreal and everyone kissed. Then there was his broken body, which she hadn't seen but conjured anyway. It felt like weeks, but it was only days since everything happened. Her eyes rode the power lines over passing fields, gray and brown mostly, the odd red house, blue car, yellow sign. Luce was always covered in flecks of paint. She had made Sarah notice color. At Sunnyside Mental Health Center, who named these places? The cop handed an envelope to the woman behind the admissions desk. Sarah wondered what was in it. She'd always been good at keeping to herself. How was there even enough information to justify funding this stay? Good luck to you, then, he squeezed her shoulder. Say hi to your Uncle Carl for me. The cop turned and walked away before she could think of what to say. Second section. So this is high school. So this is, the book starts off with Sarah. I mean, it starts off in Montreal and then in her therapy sessions, but then it goes back to her childhood. So we go through her childhood, but this is She's in high school now. High school had a different set of rules. Being neither popular nor unpopular, Sarah managed to avoid the random directives that controlled kids who had a long way to fall or a long way to climb. People who sought popularity at any cost seemed happy to see others strung up and ridiculed. That they themselves might be next seemed inconceivable. But someone needed to give a shit in the first place, otherwise the rules didn't work. For some strange reason, she and Harrison often found themselves witness to notable events. Sarah arrived at school one morning in the pouring rain, at the same time as Petra Grinder got there. Petra had thick, blonde hair and an attitude that predated the boobs she'd grown over the summer. When she was 7, the girl had been on a local TV show where kids walked around in the circle balancing books and bowls on their heads. She never got over her stardom. Neither did anyone else. Sarah would watch girls trip over themselves to eat lunch beside her and do her bidding. She could make or break anyone who cared. Dressing for weather created a divide between the kids who thought they were cool and those who had figured out that if their mom sent them to school in ugly rubber boots, they could just take them off before getting there. Sarah went for warm, dry, and stable. Petra walked, open coat and umbrella-less, to the edge of the road, pushing and pulling damp strands of hair away from her face, mindful of applying the right smile. At the curb, she paused and cast about to see who was watching her, then stepped into 5 inches of puddle. The shock signal took its time getting to her face. Still smiling, head jerking side to side, she lost what was left of solid footing. Her arms flew up, hoisting her red leatherette purse like a flag up a pole. Her mouth collapsed as she sank down on her knees and came to rest on the fabled D cups. A gaggle of lesser mortals appeared out of nowhere, mixing high-pitched concern with poorly concealed glee as they held out their hands. "Just take the fucking purse," the girl snapped, batting their arms away. Sarah, the occasional butt of Petra's nastiness, took the high road and kept her distance from the scene. She caught sight of Harrison, shoulders heaving with laughter. "Hands fucking down, that wins this year's best moment," he said. Sarah smacked him on the shoulder, snorting, which made them both laugh harder. "Makes me believe there's a god," he said. Sarah nodded, definitely the kind of god she could get behind. Later that day, Harrison dropped into a seat beside her at the library. "What's the mail out for?" He scanned the envelopes addressed to American Patriot Vanguard and Aryan Nations Church of Jesus Christ Christian. It hadn't occurred to her to cover anything. None of her sort of friends came there to work. She didn't want to make up a bunch of bullshit. It was time to say something to Harrison. "Research on white supremacy." "For school?" "No, personal interest. Mrs. Broder is helping. That's what all the storage is for. I'm tracking people in groups or clubs, neo-Nazi shit." "Looking for one to join?" He laughed, a bit uncomfortable. "Pretty much the opposite. I already left." He registered no shock. "Your family, that church?" "Basically, I came by it naturally. Now I'm trying to flush my DNA or make up for it. People know more about my family and history than I'd like to think they do. But I'd still appreciate it if this stayed between us. Your secret is safe with me. I wouldn't tell even if I had people to tell." He wouldn't. She didn't have proof. She just knew. And the last part, Sarah's now in Montreal, and Sarah's uncle is the head of a group that's called True Canadian Heritage. So it's TCH is the acronym. So she's at one of the meetings now. So, and we know that her uncle doesn't, like, he just assumes that she's, like, you know, shares the same beliefs. Sarah was heading out to Dorval every other week now. She had too much schoolwork to do, and the TCH meetings were shedding no light. It never ceased to amaze her how much people love the sound of their own voices. When she was there, she took stealthy inventory of the comings and goings, in case. On this particular day, things had deteriorated into a poorly refereed, name-slinging free-for-all from Butker to Arse Bandit, Bum Driller and Assassin, Anal Assassin, Fudge Packer. So this was where their creativity lay. The meeting had started with a rant against homo rights inspired by proposed legislation in Ontario that had barely been defeated. Carl waited until the insult... Carl's her uncle. Carl waited until the insult choices got thin to call an end to it. According to a couple of men who'd headed to Toronto to witness the vote, police had smartly worn latex gloves to protect themselves from AIDS-carrying protesters. Where exactly were those cops planning to stick their fingers? Everyone nodded like gloves was a perfectly normal thing to do. Even Dr. Trotter, who supposedly knew a thing or two about transmission and infection control. Clearly, they weren't worried enough not to push people down the stairs to get them out of the legislature building. Some politician had even claimed the homos used cattle prods for sexual entertainment. Club members loved the gory details, but barely defeated was barely defeated. The country was at risk. It was late fall, but hot inside the clubhouse. The smell reminded Sarah of church. The windows were steamed up from all the heavy breathing. Some folks got suspiciously overexcited about the topic. Any minute, mini donuts would start flying. We need action, or this abomination will quash any vestige of decency across the country. The speaker, whom Sarah hadn't met, another average guy dressed like her uncle in khakis and a golf shirt, seemed proud of himself for using words like quash and vestige. Too many folks are apathetic and lazy. My son's gay and it's okay. It's not bloody okay. All you need is a bunch of confused kids with raging hormones who'd be happy for anyone to yank their chain.
I'm gonna grab one of these here.
And there's no stopping it. He might have looked bland, but his reference to hand jobs was genius. People like being shocked and titillated. He understood that and worked it. An older man started grumbling about Quebec eroding the traditional family. Then he got onto the Catholics and men who wore dresses like the Pope. Mr. Khaki Pants coughed loudly, thanked him for his thoughts, and moved along. Disrespect for traditional values is trouncing the economy, and decent white folks are leaving Montreal. Then they started reviewing a draft letter to the Premier of Quebec. Someone fumbled with the knob on the overhead projector until it came into focus. It would have made as much sense out of focus. So that's the reading part. So I thought I would just talk a little bit about how I came to write this book. And I will say that I was actually in the Ontario legislature for that particular nasty voting situation on Bill 167 in 1994. So, and it was an unbelievable scene, like exactly as it was told, with the cops wearing their latex gloves. And anyway, during the 1990s, I was involved in an activist group and doing like anti-fascist and anti-racist activism in Toronto at a time when like the Heritage Front and Ernst Zundel were very, like there was a lot of neo-Nazi white supremacist activity in the country and certainly in the city at that time. And I did activism at that time. And I also had a friend who I met somewhat later, a very dear friend who was doing infiltration into a neo-Nazi women's group in Montreal. So all of these started percolating in my head. What was kind of interesting at the time, there was a certain amount of coverage in the papers, in the Globe and in the Star at that time, but it almost depicted, it depicted the white supremacists as fringe almost in the same way that it depicted the anti-racist activists also as fringe. Like we were all sort of seen as like troublemakers on equal types of troublemakers on both sides. And so it sort of made me think a lot about what this experience might be like, about marginalization, about who actually lives on the edges, about sort of about misfits and belonging. And so that's what made me think about the book. I worked on it. I didn't start it right at that time. I started it a few years later, but it sort of on and off, I worked on it for close to a decade and a half, so a long time. And what was interesting, it's an interesting thing to write a book over like the course of so much change, social change and political change and legislative change. So the book, like a book in that case, is not static. It's in constant dialogue with the times, which makes it interesting. So I thought a lot about the fact that if it had come out, like I did start trying to shop around a version of it when Obama was the president of the United States, and it would have been a very, very different book at that time. It would have kind of been like, oh, too bad, so sad, very unfortunate for her, but not really, not any great worry. Things were sort of moving progressively in a direction. We had our first Black American president of the United States. But with the book coming out, despite the fact that I really wanted it to get published, I really did try to find an agent, now is its moment. And now it is like a very sort of terrifying, a terrifying book. It's like a cautionary tale more than it is just like a sad story that happened to someone at a time when, you know, things were worse. Things are pretty bad right now with, you know, I mean, I don't have to go on about this, but with rights being denied, you know, like gay and lesbian rights, trans rights, women's rights, abortion rights, voting rights, like they're just like it's just sort of shocking that this is where we are at this point. Yeah. So, yeah, that's maybe I'll leave it at that. And I have like a few other things to say, but maybe I'll let if you guys have any questions for me and things you want to talk about or ask.
Did you have anybody in particular that you, or a family, that you researched that Sarah's based on?
No. But the friend of mine who did infiltration into into this white supremacist group in Montreal, like she comes from a family that's very long white WASPy family that's very established in Ontario. This is not her family's history. But what was interesting, I think, to me about. Like, I think she sort of felt that because she passed so easily in that world, that she had a responsibility to expose it. It's not like to expose other people who looked very much like her but had those beliefs. So it wasn't based on any family that I knew. I'd read about different people who were involved in like the Heritage Front and those kinds of organizations. Especially in and around Toronto at that time, but I just made that up. Made up the family.
Okay. But was she in any danger when she was infiltrating it, or your friend?
I don't think that she was never exposed, and she wasn't like she didn't do it for a super long time, and she wasn't in Montreal long enough. I mean, I think that's always a risk. For sure, that's always a risk, but I don't think she perceived herself to be in any danger, and she felt that the risk was worth it.
Could you share a little bit about the whole process of getting published and how that kind of changed given the climate that exists now? And
sure. I try to find an agent. For quite a number of years, and I sent it around, and I got all sorts of like very interesting. Like the thing about an agent as opposed to a publisher, and the book is published by Rebooks. It's Rebecca Eckler's press, and she was extremely excited about it when she got it. But like a press can take those kinds of risks in the way that. Agents won't necessarily. Like they're out to make money, and I had everything from somebody telling me. That it was not a timely topic, and I was kind of like, really? Like, you can tell me that you don't want to take the book on because you don't actually think you'll be able to make money off of it, but don't tell me it's not a timely book. So, and I sent it to a lot of Americans. I have to say that at least the Americans bothered to respond, which is very kind. Canada was like less kind. In some ways, I like often just did not get responses at all, which is kind of crappy. Yeah. And then, you know, a couple of years ago, I was having a conversation with a friend of mine, not like somebody I don't know well, who is also a writer and not white. And she said to me that she would be willing to read it. Like, I was at the time sort of trying to figure out, like, is it done? Is it done? Is it done? Like, every time somebody says, I'm not going to take the book, you wonder, is it because it's not done? And that was hard. I felt very, like, sort of pulled in different directions around, like, how confident I felt that the story was complete. You know, and she said, and it was kind of funny, you know, it was sort of like, you know, no offense, but like, cry me a river for this poor girl who grew up in a white supremacist family, you know, with a bunch of like loving a bunch of haters, you know. So, and I thought a lot about that at the time and thought, you know, maybe it's not my time. And I was also, I will say, like, excited about a lot of changes that seemed to be happening in society, a lot more opportunities for BIPOC folks to get things published, moving into higher positions in the arts and in publishing. And unfortunately, that really came in a wave, and then it went. You know, that in the 2 years that followed, like, the murder of George Floyd, there was a whole bunch of scrambling around to make changes, and they didn't last. So, anyway, I've thought a lot about all of those things in terms of the timing of this book and it being. I don't know if I'm actually really answering your question. It's like, if you're asking because you're interested in putting out your own writing too. If I'm not being very, but it's.
No, oh, but I'm okay. Just interested in the whole process.
Yeah, it is. It's
especially given the topic and how it has changed.
Yeah. And it's I do feel like this is its moment, in a lot of ways, and comparing sort of what's going on in the 1990s, you know, versus what's going on right now is, it's, there are too many similarities and too many horrifying things that are not similar. This is a time of huge permission for these types of beliefs, and, you know, whether that's completely a Donald Trump thing, in great part it is. Like, people now feel like they should be able to express, you know, I have my pride exactly the way that you have your pride. And it's like, yeah, but your pride is built on the hatred of other people. Okay. You know, that's problematic. But now I think people feel, I see it a lot in the States right now, and probably just in the build-up to this election. But, you know, all over the place, I think all over this country as well, just this sense that I get to have these views and express these views publicly. And in the 90s, I think it felt like people were still, not that they were ashamed necessarily, but that they felt that you just didn't say those things in public. You know, everything was moving in a direction, you know, that suggested you not do that. That, in fact, you could end up somehow having legal problems if you were going to make those, you know, I'm not going to rent you my place, I'm not going to give you a job. Like, you just, and now that seems to just be like, you know, if you hold those religious beliefs, then those are legitimate beliefs in order to, like, deny a gay couple, like, a cake baked in your particular, you know, in your establishment. Or whatever. So, mm-hmm.
Yeah. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying. So 1994 took you about 2010 to do the research, and then did you start writing after that?
Yeah, I started. Yeah, I started writing around then. I was not. It was more like. I did the research almost at the same time as I was writing the book. It was sort of percolating as an idea. I hadn't actually started writing it. And I have to say, it mutated a lot. There are a lot of characters that were killed off. There are a lot of locations. She was just, like, whipping all over the country. She was in Vancouver, in Orangeville. It was like, Aviva, I think you have to, like, I think Sarah has to just, like, there just have to be, like, 3 places and not, like, 10 places. But, sorry, I lost my train by,
It's okay. It's just, I'm just, like, so much has changed, like, from 94, 2010, you know, then
yeah.
The pandemic in 2020, and then I'm just wondering, like, and then, like,
I did also,
society.
I wanted to just, really? Warren Kinsella, who is a Canadian, like, he's a journalist and a lawyer, he wrote a book in the mid-1990s called Web of Hate that tracked all, like, white supremacy in Canada, some in the United States as well, but mostly in this country. And a lot of this book is grounded in those historical events. It names people that were very active in that movement at the time. But I think that's what I was sort of trying to say to before, that it is a weird thing to write a book over this much, over this period of time. And one of the things that happened too, is that I think more and more my reticence to actually just categorize people as either bad or good kind of fell away. And I feel like that doesn't serve us. So the book really does try to understand, like, the members of Sarah's family. I mean, it's not a forgiveness thing. It's just, if we don't understand how people's beliefs grow and, you know, and fester, mm-hmm. like, resentment, fear, then we screw ourselves by not understanding that. And I think that as we've seen different, like, populists get elected in different countries, it would serve us to understand what underlies why people feel the way that they do. And some people are just, they're just, like, nasty, and there will never be anything but nasty, and it's not worth investing time. But I think I came over time, like the father character that you'll, when you read the book, he's not without empathy. You know, I have empathy towards him. And, you know, it's, the book deals a lot with intergenerational family trauma, you know, and I chose white supremacy as the place to situate that, but any different form of intolerance or extremism, like, you could situate this story in any of those kinds of worlds or communities, and it would be, you know, the same sort of things when those views are just passed down from generation to generation with all of these expectations, and with sometimes, like, you know, violence as well, you know, in those families. So it's there's a lot going on, and it felt to me, and I felt that long amount of time to write the book, like, I feel like that changed somewhat. Like, I feel like I was a lot harder on some of the characters, like, more categorical than I ended up being. And I think it served the book in the end to not be black and white, to not be binary. Mm-hmm. And I feel that, I've thought a lot about that just in terms of my own thinking about the world over the last year, about people's inclination to have categorical extreme views on one side or another, and how it doesn't serve us well. So somebody, when I did the launch in Toronto, one of the questions that was asked was about the theme of friendship in the book. And it's really not the kinds of friendships that are easy friendships, where it's like you share the same views, you grew up in the same place, you see facts in the same way. Really more about friendships that are harder, where you are reaching out across difference in order to make those connections. And I quoted when I was talking about Hannah Arendt, the philosopher Hannah Arendt, who basically suggested that, you know, friendship is the best tool to fight, like, forces that seek to deny individuality and dignity. So, and those are the forces of totalitarianism and fascism as she understood them. So she was talking about kind of like a big F kind of friendship. And in the book, even though Sarah is, like, she finds friendships really difficult, I think she feels in some ways there's a lot of shame that she carries, so she feels like she's a threat to people and maybe best to kind of not get too attached. But, you know, I believe in the end, like, friendship wins. And so that's kind of an important theme throughout the book of making those kinds of connections, despite the fact that you may not share similar views about everything.
Thank you.
Thank you for asking.
Yes. I was wondering, you're looking at the back and looking, you do memoir as well.
Yeah.
And they're like, ooh, is this memoir? and then, so what, would you tell us a little bit about your other stuff that you've done, writing stuff that you've done in the past?
Sure. I worked for the Ontario government for like 22 years, and then I took a year's self-funded leave to dabble in writing, and then I ended up never going back. I was diagnosed with lymphoma also a couple of years later, and then I started writing a lot about that. But I wrote about parenting initially, A bunch of different things I wrote about. I wrote a series about cancer for the Globe and Mail, and then I published a book called Lost and Found in Lymphoma Land, which is a memoir about, like, I was blogging all the way through it, and so I put that together and wrote a book about that. I've written sort of, I'm a humorist, basically, so that's why I wrote this really funny book. So I wrote a piece about not shopping for a year. I didn't shop for a year. And then I wrote a book. I wrote a piece about decluttering. I've sort of a real range of things that just grab me. I wrote a piece for Toronto Life many years ago when my kid was little, when we were trying, I was having a difficult time with his my co-parent, trying to decide about putting him on drugs, on ADHD drugs, and it was a huge tension. So I wrote about that. Like, so basically, like a whole bunch of different topics. It's not, it's not a livable wage by any stretch, but it's easier for me writing about myself, like writing about. You know, writing those stories is a lot easier. But it's interesting because the other conversation I've had about the book is about fiction and about telling stories through fiction and whether there's more truth in memoir, because it's like it actually happened to me. But the fact is, like, the only part of memoir that is true is exactly what happened to me. The rest is speculation. You know, when I'm speculating on what somebody else is feeling or what they're thinking when I'm in a particular environment, that's as much fiction as this is fiction. And I think fiction gives you permission, like, to pull a whole bunch of different perspectives together in a way that writing, you know, biographies or memoir or anything can't. But yeah, so a whole range of stuff, not thematically consistent whatsoever. I did write a piece when the Raptors were in the finals, like in the lead up, about being a fair weather fan. It was really, because all of a sudden, like, I knew all the names, I knew all the players, and it was like, which struck me as hilarious because I didn't watch, I watched no sports, and all of a sudden, like, I was a huge basketball fan. So that was fun.
So did you have a... No, you go.
What are you working on now? That's like a follow-up.
I have two novels that are on the go. One of them is actually set, it opens the night of the American election in 2016. It's a mother and daughter story. The mother voted for Trump, arguably because of her, like, financial. She thought that financially that was a smart thing to do. And the daughter, like, was a Hillary. And she was super excited. It's, like, the night of the, you know, finally the night of the election. They live in Arizona where, like, no one in their neighborhood actually voted for Hillary Clinton. But, and she... you know, and we know how that turned out. She had planned to take this holiday, like a camping trip by herself. She's like 17 years old, or 16. She's just turning 17. She's planning to take this like 2 weeks to go out into Gila, New Mexico, camping by herself to celebrate like the first female president of the United States. And she goes anyway. And it's sort of the story of what happens to her. She meets two ghosts while she's out there. The ghost, one of them is the ghost of Chris McCandless, who...
the book's right there, by the way.
Into the Wild, yeah. Which I love that book. And the other ghost is somebody who also... Like, she's sort of... It's an examination of why it is that people walk away from society completely. And the other part of the story is the mother frantically trying to figure out where her kid is because she didn't actually leave any information about where she was going. So that's one novel. And the other one is set in Pittsburgh. You can see I decided, oh, maybe you should set these books in the United States, Aviva. Maybe you'll get more interest. But... And it's about a woman in her mid-50s who's like a math whiz and who has all of her life worked for a little money management firm because she didn't have the money to continue her, like her at Carnegie Mellon to do a PhD. And she ends up finding out that the boss that she absolutely adored, he has a heart attack. You find this out right at the beginning of the story. He has a heart attack. And this new guy steps into the role, and she finds out not only like how horrible the new guy is, but all this awful stuff about the guy that she so adored, and the nasty. It's sort of a Me Too type of a book. So that's, and then it's a sort of the mystery of her trying to unravel what actually was going on in this firm, and having to like join forces with women that she was like held in great disdain. You know, all these women that she thought, anyway, that's the story. That's the other one. So I'm sort of working on those two. Right now, all I'm doing is like dragging the book around wherever I can, this one, wherever I can take it. But hopefully I'll get back to those stories too. Yeah.
Does Sarah, without giving anything away, because I know that's why we're here to read the book, does Sarah get any kind of redemption?
It's funny because somebody actually asked me that, and I did say, I won't tell you, but there is a progression. Like the main relationship in the novel is a therapeutic relationship. So she is on her way, as we know, to Sunnyside, and she's going to be working with this therapist named Mona. So it would be really unfortunate if the whole book was a therapeutic relationship where there was no progress, you know, because she really comes from a family where it's like therapy, like what the fuck, like nobody, like we don't do that. So I would say, there is movement in a good direction. A lot of it is sort of self realizations, you know, learning more about herself through that process in a way that she really was like, who needs to learn things about themselves? So that's okay. It's not a very, probably not a very satisfying answer, but
no, it was good. It gave me a little more insight.
So I don't know. Yes.
I'm sorry, more questions. I'm wondering, like, when you were working with the publisher, I'm just curious, was there a lot of pressure to, let's say, categorize it? I know, like, American, especially in the American publishing scene, it's like, it must be a genre. We Canadians are a little bit more flexible. I'm just curious about what that experience was, if you felt the pressure to, like,
help a certain... I didn't, but a couple of people were like, is it YA? And I'm like, no. Like, it's... really not YA. I mean, I know that the YA novels these days are more... there's sex. It's absolutely not YA in this book. But... and the full story doesn't feel very YA. But, so in that sense, there's, like... I would call it, like, a, like, political slash domestic fic. Like, it really... it mixes those genres. I don't think a lot of people... there's not a lot of political fiction that's written... I don't think that gets published. Like, there's way less than there are, like, domestic romance. I didn't... And you know what? They do that themselves.
Yeah.
They don't even ask you what you consider the book to be. So they just, like...
You don't have to categorize it at all. I'm just wondering if you face that kind of...
Yeah, no, I mean, it's like... but it is interesting when I go online. There are... it does... it, and I'm like, wait, what? Like, what's it doing in that category? Sports. No. So I didn't feel any pressure to do that myself. But, yeah. I don't know if anyone else has any other questions, or if that's... we're all good. You can have some cheese. Get some more wine or whatever. Thank you so much for coming. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
So lovely.
And you just heard from an October 29th book launch event at Novel Idea Bookstore. You heard Toronto-based editor and writer Aviva Rubin launching her debut novel called White. Tell you what, let's go ahead and do this, and I will be right back.
CFRC's funding drive is now underway and running through December 31st. Donate today and get amazing CFRC prizes. For every $5 you donate, you also earn a ticket for one of our weekly raffle draws featuring prizes from local businesses including Old Farm Fine Foods, The Screening Room, Smokes Poutinerie, Studio 330, Tango Nuevo, Terra Natural Foods, The Toucan, The Wit, and YGK Thrift. Enjoy the benefits of donating. Give today via CFRC.ca.
Friday evenings at 6 p.m. here on CFRC, listen to Saltwater Music, a show covering all musical genres from the East Coast of Canada. Celtic, of course, but also rock, jazz, blues, folk, and a lot more. I'm your host, Rob Carnell. Tune in to Saltwater Music Friday evening from 6 to 8 here on CFRC 101.9 FM. Or you can catch us on the web at www.cfrc.ca. And for our listeners out east, that's 7 p.m. Atlantic and 7:30 Newfoundland.
Hello, CFRC listeners. This is Christina Laurie, CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative news reporter. CFRC's annual funding drive campaign is now underway through December 31st, and you can help CFRC keep our listeners informed on issues that matter with modernized broadcasting equipment and trained team members. Help CFRC hit our $25,000 fundraising goal this year by donating today at cfrc.ca.
Have you been dumped? Left all alone? Just want to find your soulmate? Look no further, because your new best friend is waiting for you at the Kingston Humane Society. The Kingston Humane Society is a nonprofit animal organization founded in 1884 that is supported solely by the community, receiving no government funding to assist in their mission of caring for injured, abused, and homeless animals, with the goal of creating families and homes for the animals. They are the only open shelter in the region, accepting every animal brought to them with compassion, respect, and humane assistance. If you want to donate to help these animals find their best friends, or if you're interested in finding the new love of your life, please visit KingstonHumaneSociety.ca. Everyone just needs a little love.
And I do have some calls and events to yet share with you this hour, and we'll end the hour with a song. I let you know that. So I hope you can stay tuned for that. But first, my heartfelt thanks to all of you for having tuned into the show today, and an equal thanks to both authors today, Francois and Aviva, and a heartfelt thanks again to, as always, Novel Idea Bookstore for their time and space, and being a wonderful host for so many book launches and other events that come through there. I will say you are and have been listening to Finding a Voice here on CFRC 101.9 FM. We are located in Lower Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. My name is Bruce. I'm here every Friday afternoon from 4 to 6 o'clock. We do stream live online at www.cfrc.ca. And just an hourly reminder, both hours of this show are uploaded to my blog space for it at Finding a Voice on cfrcfm.wordpress.com will remain there for 4 years, or 3 years, I'm sorry. As we start to end the show, it is almost 49 minutes after 5 o'clock. I just want to say, I hope you heard a little plug for it, his plug, Rob's plug. Please stay tuned for 2 hours of East Coast music in a show called Saltwater Music, hosted again by Rob Carnell, right at the top of the hour. And I hope you can tune in here again next week as well. So with those said, I'm just going to just quickly mention, I fell in love with this radio station when the first time I stepped in here, God, I don't even know, 17 years ago, something like that. Have had a radio show here for 14 and a half, and it's been an honor to be able to bring a lot of local poets and writers to this place and give them a bigger audience and let them expose their work and also just like you heard today, sometimes too people, other authors passing through. So again, our funding drive runs from, I should just say it runs now until December 31st. I do personally know a few people who have already donated, so my heartfelt thanks to them and all of you out there who have already donated. If you haven't, go to www.cfrc.ca, and when that page opens up, you'll see a donate button at the top of the page. Just click on that, and it will give you all the information you need. And every little bit helps. Again, thank you. I do have just a couple of minutes here for some events. And one I will mention, because I just found out about it today, and so I haven't mentioned this. There is an exhibit at the Windows Art Gallery called Youth Imagine the Future Festival. It's at Kingston School of Arts. Window Art Gallery, that is located at 647 Princess Street, Unit 101. This event or this exhibition runs through December 15th. Their hours, their gallery hours are Tuesday 10 to 5, Wednesday through Friday 10 to 3, and Saturday and Sunday noon to 4. And so it will be up for another week and a couple of days, I guess. You can go to their website, www.ksoa.info, and again, Sunday, December 15th. So another event coming up is the monthly multi-genre event called Quirks of Human Nature, which is poetry performed with improvised music monthly. Again, featured this month on December 16th. So what is that? A week from Monday, I guess. So about 10 days away. Poetry and spoken word artist featured is Harlequin Crow. Deb Shermans is on piano and also co-MC. Music, Shenanigans, which consists of Ann Archer on flute and John McClurg on guitar. And there may be storytelling as well. If that's the case, it will be Selena Shirelli. And bonus poets are Anna Johnson, and there will be more. It's still being, they're being rounded up. And Meg Freer organizes and MCs that event. Again, that is December 16th, Monday, December 16th from 7:30 to 9:30 p.m. Probably this show next week, too. That would be ahead of that. I'm most likely going to be, there's still several book launches I haven't aired yet. So that will probably be devoted to, I'll probably be able to air at least a couple of those. That's kind of the game plan. But I do have a Facebook page, group page for the show. It's Finding a Voice on CFRC FM. No, that's not it. It is, I don't know if I have it listed here. Just go on Facebook, Finding a Voice on CFRC 101.9 FM. Check it out on Facebook if you want to know. By Thursday of the week, you'll have Friday's show there. Again, I want to thank you for tuning in today. Getting pretty close now. Let me see what time I've got here. Yeah, I've got a couple more minutes. So I just want to thank all of you again for tuning into the show this afternoon. I hope you enjoyed what were two really very nice reading and launch events at Novel Idea. And I've decided I'm going to play a song to take us out of here and take us right up to 6 o'clock, and then Saltwater Music starts with Rob Carnell. I've chosen Radiohead, and actually one of my favorite songs of theirs, and it's called How to Disappear. And have a great week, everybody.
that's not me. I go where I please. I walk through walls. I float down. I'm not here. This isn't happening. I'm not here. I'm not. Already passed.